Hello, everybody. Welcome all to our 23rd East Hampton Poetry Marathon. This is our second in a four-week series, so there are still two more weekends to come, July 23rd and July 29th. So the East Hampton Poetry Marathon is now in its 23rd year, I'm happy to say. And tonight we will be audio recording this for a community radio station, WPKN, which is 89.5, if I'm not mistaken, yes. And it airs on the fourth Wednesday of each month at 7:30 p.m. And you can go online and pull up previous sessions, and there should have been a piece of paper on your chairs if you'd like to have more information about that. It'll be something that you can always enjoy in the future. So today I'm going to turn the floor over to Pauline Yates. Pauline Yates is a fellow colleague. She's a poet. She's a designer. She's an artist. She's an entrepreneur. And we meet regularly with a group of local poets to enjoy a poetry workshop on Monday nights in the East Hampton Library. And from that, we're carrying the banner forward on 22 years of poetry marathons. So I'll turn the floor over to Pauline Yates to introduce our two poets for tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Dee. So here at our convocation of East Hampton poets, which is kind of like a gaggle of geese, I suppose, but we're going to introduce Grace Shulman and Elise Passion. And, you know, poets are always talking about, you know, what the nature of poetry is. And if we look at our poets' names today, we can find two ideas, grace and passion. And both of those words evoke poetry. We tend to think of grace and passion as human characteristics, but if we look deeper, we can see that they're actually qualities of existence itself. And the same could be said of poetry. A poet can find poetry in anything. So these our two poets tonight really represent those ideas, those two ideas. And our first poet is that we're introducing tonight is Elise Passion. And Elise is the winner of the Nicholas Roerich Poetry Prize for her book, Bestiary Infidelities. She'll be reading from her most recent work, The Nightlife, with poems exploring the drama between the life lived and the life imagined. For Elise, you know, this idea of the juxtaposition of the mythic life and the domestic life in relationships is something that she has really explored deeply. And as the daughter of Osage prima ballerina Maria Tallchief, her poems often speak of what she calls family romance, passion that lies at the intersection of mythic and the domestic, the life lived, the life imagined. To illustrate a few brief excerpts from her poem, Parents at Rest, from the first stanza, how in the afternoon they would lie on the angled couch, toe to toe, his side, hers. And then the second stanza, how he waited for her these many years in the graveyard below her childhood home, where now they sleep together beneath the rhapsody of Meadowsweet. Please welcome Elise Passion, reading today from her new work, The Nightlife.
Thank you so much. That was such a beautiful introduction. And I wanted to thank Dee so much for orchestrating this event. Thanks to all of you for being here. And I also just want to say what an honor it is for me to read with Grace Shulman. Grace has been my poetry godmother for many, many years, and I adore her, and I'm so happy to be sharing the lectern with you tonight. So thank you, Grace. I'm going to read just two poems from my other two books, And why I'm doing that is I was here in the 90s, and I was actually at this museum and was inspired by the museum and wrote a poem based on the museum. So I thought I'd better read that poem to all of you. The poem is called Salvage. It's from my first book called Infidelities. And in this book, there are a lot of poems about love gone wrong. So in those days, I was not married. And this was about a very tortured relationship, a poet that I was madly in love with. I went to graduate school in Oxford, at Oxford University. And the epigraph comes from one of these exhibits, which was the Shipwrecks exhibit from the East Hampton Town Marine Museum. And it reads, "Salvage washed ashore from a vessel was felt by the townspeople to be rightfully theirs." Salvage. When you carried over the box from Tesco's and loaded it up with your possessions, 45s from the 60s, hoarded away like rare doubloons in my crawl space, I knew this time you meant to go. Closing the door, you ambled down the street, whistling perhaps Slow Boat to China. We had navigated that craft in flats leased out to us by finders keepers. And we toss, rising, falling on high seas. What salvage had you left tucked away upstairs in the closet? Your cricket bat, a plastic carton weighted with hay pennies and pennies, towels, a tapestry which mirrored l'après-midi d'enfant. For several years, I stored it all, loading and unloading the goods from terrace house to house in Oxford, waiting for you to make your claim. Now more years separate our lives than those we shared. So I designed a boat and launched it off to China, hoisting towels as sails and rigging up a rudder bat for ballast that tapestry. I watched it shrink, small as a coin, as it approached the edge, cresting the horizon. Phoning from London, you ask the Atlantic between us if I have saved your belongings. So I'm so thrilled that my new book, The Nightlife, has just been published. It came out in May. And I want to share those poems with you right now. When I first drafted this first poem after the squall, I had in the back of my mind the myth of Pandora's jar, a container filled with bottled up emotions. Only after it was finished did I realize that I had written an Ars Poetica, or a poem about the act of writing a poem. And this poem is called After the Squall. I also tried to choose poems today with sort of sea imagery. I love the ocean, and it's really wonderful being here. After the squall, in need of air, she unhinged every window, revolving ones downstairs, upstairs skylights, mid-floor French doors, swept into the house the salt brine, the cricket chirp, the osprey whistle, the sea current, sound of the sound, but had not noticed the basement bedroom window shielded by blinds, screenless. Later that night, when they returned home, lights illuminating the downstairs hall, insects inhabited the ground floor rooms. She carried handfuls of creatures across a river Styx, the katydids perched on lampshades, beach tiger beetles shuttling across floorboards, nursery web spiders splotching the ceiling, trying to put back the wild fury she had released. I write in forms, and I write mostly metrical poetry. And this next poem I wrote in two different columns. And in it, you should be able to read the poem both horizontally and vertically. I'm going to read it horizontally, and the epigraph comes from W.H. Auden's poem, Musée des Beaux-Arts, and it reads, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window. And I hope you'll have a sense of these two columns as I read, the two sort of different voices. Closing house. You pack books and boxes, dismantle library shelves. White caps after the storm, the beach is packed, a stretch of sand, no lifeguard. Empty the freezer, cookie dough ice cream, bratwursts. The doctor's children beg to swim. He answers no, water's too rough. From tree to tree, fill thistle in goldfinch feeders. Past the sandbar, two teenage boys' kayak hits high waves, overturns. Stack beach towels like cityscapes on laundry racks. In choppy waters, the boys shout. Their mother on the beach cries out. Bubble wrap vases, lock the crystal in dark cabinets. Wading into the lake, the doctor pushes the pair back to the sandbar. Roll down umbrellas, empty out the kiddie pool. But a six-footer hits, drags under. Current hauls him into the riptide. Water impatience, pluck tomatoes from heavy vine. Pediatric surgeon dies trying to rescue drowning boys. Carry the last bag from the house. Load the car. Drive past Cherry Beach. No sirens. No helicopters. Sky ablaze. Immaculate day. My last book was called Bestiary, and the animal world managed to creep into these poems as well. This next poem was inspired by an invasion of wolf spiders. Do you have wolf spiders here? Yes? No? Anybody know? Sorry? So this is in Michigan. Takes place in a house in Michigan. It's called Skeen. He warned they would arrive, web stretching between deck chairs and table, harnessing limbs, loose hair. But she couldn't hear, ignoring. Then she saw filigree etched in windows, shook off traps, pulled into spun collars. She asked, how can we stay above board, treading water? She asked, stepping across flagstones from house to pond, as if she did not know, unraveling like threads, strands of her clothes. So the epigraph for the book is from Elizabeth Bishop's poem, Sleeping Standing Up. It reads, the armored car of dreams contrived to let us do so many a dangerous thing. Many of these poems are taken from actual dreams. And this next poem is one of those dream narratives. It's the third part of a longer sequence called Picnic Triptych. And it's called Half There. It was a summer's day. It was cold as winter. He invited her down to the river, then pretended they never met. They drank beside the Roaring Fork. Chilled, she left without a wrap. He shadowed her uphill. She entered the house alone. She didn't lock the door. The door was locked. On the bedroom floor she slept. He left an imprint there. She woke to the slam of a door. The room was empty. Under the wing of roof, no one spoke of this again. So I think we all may have shared the experience of this next poem, and it's called The Middle Seat. It's in rhyming couplets. What space can we attempt to claim, bracketed here inside a plane? The seat backdrops, a paradox. You're packed inside a folding box. Each bookend stakes out territory. Is this her armrest? Whose fresh story? Embrace your own invisible. in fiction, find a miracle. Invent a life from something lost, a ticket to another coast. We land where we've lived before. The heart darts through the open door. So we have two teenage children, and watching them grow up can be both exhilarating and heartbreaking. I wrote this next poem several years ago while watching our son, Stephen, walking down the street. Stephen, I feel, is a wonderful musician. He's a classical pianist, plays jazz piano, picked up the trumpet. So there's a musical theme to this poem, and it's called Impromptu. When he ambles ahead, then looks sideways to scan the street, as if sight-reading sheet music, I see him several years from now, awkward, 12 inches taller, stooping to clear an overhang of gangly branches, and try to fix this moment's pitch, as if fine-tuning chords on the keys of a piano, how he ad-libs his gait across a sidewalk slab, scattering grace notes behind each step. So in the audience is my dear friend, the novelist Thea Goodman, and I'm staying with Thea and her husband, Eric Oliver, this weekend. Thank you. And Thea and I went on a mini writer's retreat to Point Reyes, and it was a very inspiring place for me, again, by the ocean. So these next two poems are the Point Reyes poems. The first one is called, they're both in two parts. So the overall title of this first poem is called Shifting Ground, and part one is High Tide, Mid-Marriage. The streak of sun through slat, the slap of brine, sharp mollusks dug deep, how love stays calm, the plates hunkering through storm stacked up, how water rises to fill the tureen of bay to brim, the queen and knight squared off, slow draw. This palm in yours will cup a sea or salt, shell welded to sand. How sun arcs, crowns, dashed gemstone sheet, bracelet of wave. Part two, Stilt Cottage, Low Tide. Where the leopard shark's two-chambered heart hammers, neighboring skeins of brant geese doze on the gray sheet slate, the punctuated white of their tails flick the sun, citizens of the sheen floating, while the stockbrokers dial quick calls and the judges elsewhere pummel their gavels. In eelgrass, herring eggs quiver. A newscaster announces, reindeer herders stumble upon colossal craters in permafrost. Our cottage, cantilevered above a strike-slip fault, hovers above the estuary. I watch a lone brant dive where shells lie open, cracked, this tendency to drift. And this next poem is called Riddle. Again, in two parts. Skylight above the bed where sun and moon swap, you chart the arc, hours, the deck, the window, pulse or surf, a clock of what's sea-locked. Inside ink dark, that sweet secretes, covert and whirl, maker of shell, beyond the flume, the shade-backed hump, O Inverness, elsewhere you toss that darker half as moon slips into. So I'm going to conclude with two poems. And I wrote this next-to-last poem when I was here last summer after attending our friend's 50th birthday. And I wanted to create a poem that was sort of like a bossa nova type of poem. And so I hope I get this feeling across. The title is from a bossa nova song, which is Quiet Nights of Quiet Stars. Midsummer, hum of candlelight, glinting like midsummer, hum of candlelight, glinting like notes across the grass, while across Gardner's Bay lies the shoulder of an island, asleep, reclining on its side, head cradled in elbow, and across the lawn the slow notes of bossa nova, and someone speaking in sotto voce, and duct tape sealed across a tear in a dress, and switchgrass, and paths in the dark, the silent disco, thunder of limbs before a slow swim as the moon shelters behind a boulder. The next morning, ashes, sacred and spilled, tossed by the wind, scatter between the cords of waves below slumbering cliffs. The taste of salt, what you might call its aftermath. And my last poem is a poem about, it was a poem in which I attempted to grapple the subject of my mother's dementia. So she was a very well-known prima ballerina, and after my father died, she slipped away and slipped into this terrible illness of dementia. And I think when I wrote this poem, I was able to come to terms with this illness. I guess one thing you need to know about the poem is that my mother originated the role of Eurydice in Balanchine's ballet Orpheus. So here's an attempt to reprise that myth. My mother descends. After he died, she slipped away, visiting her husband, my father, every night in the underworld. At dinner, she hides spoons inside her sleeves. After sunset, she crosses the river Styx, braving storm-torn waves. Rehearsing death, she lies in bed for 12-hour stints. The skiff, so fragile, shakes when she recovers her balance. When she descends to bring him back, clouds skim her eyes. She cannot see, catching only glints of his silver hair. There's never enough cutlery for Charon. Cerberus snarls hot. What she wouldn't give to convince Hades. Awake at sunrise, her limbs heavy, ache from the labor. She is weary and observes silence with the living. Thank you so much.
You can find copies of Elise's book, The Nightlife, at the end of the reading. So now we're going to honor and welcome our beloved East Hampton neighbor, Ray Shulman, also of New York City, distinguished professor of English at Baruch College. Last year, she received the Poetry Society of America's Frost Medal for Distinguished Lifetime Achievement in American Poetry. Her numerous honors include the Aiken Taylor Award for Modern American Poetry, 5 Pushcart Prizes, and fellowships from the New York Council on the Arts and the Guggenheim Foundation. A former poetry editor of The Nation, Grace Shulman has published 7 poetry collections. Described by Harold Bloom as a vital and permanent poet, young Grace, at age 14, sent her first poem to the poet Marianne Moore, who profoundly influenced her work. She later studied at Bard College and at New York University and wrote her doctoral dissertation on Moore's poetry. She's been called a poet of praise, and Grace Shulman's poetry addresses the founding question: how and why do we find grace and beauty in adversity? Here's a brief example from her poem, Balm in Gilead. Is there no balm in Gilead? So cries Dur Jeremiah in granite tones. There is a balm in Gilead, replies the Negro spiritual. The baritone who chants it, leaning forward on the platform, looks up, not knowing his voice is a rainstorm that rinses air to reveal Earth's surprises. Her recent poems deal with conflicting states of marriage and celebrate aspects of Springs, her East Hampton home. So please join me in a warm welcome for Grace Shulman.
What a beautiful introduction. I feel as though I should just go home. It's really a pleasure to be here again and an honor to be reading with Elise Passion, whose poems have gone from distinguished to eminent. I'm really entranced by her new work, especially. And I love the introduction. I should add a footnote, though. When I did send my poems to Marianne Moore at the age of 14, she wrote back and said, "The flawless typing shows the work to its best advantage." She had a way of putting a positive spin on everything. I'd like to start with a poem just because we've been there today, and you know it, I'm sure. Fireplace Bay, which is at the end of Fireplace Road. And it's one of our treasures in Springs. Where are the fires that crackled on this hill? The leap, the sparks, the urgency of wood smoke, fires that singed if you came near, that heightened conversations, shadowed sunken jaws. The Montauk people stoked magenta flames that warned of danger. The colonists tossed seaweed over fires for smoke that twisted into bearded clouds and sent words across the sound. Food is on its way, smoke clouds replying, sheep's wool newly sheared, ready for transport. Fires that spoke. Last night a cedar fell in the downpour, crashing power lines. My mobile fails for the lack of towers. Computers sleep in this speechless neighborhood. I dream of fires and of a surfman who recounts his catch in stories that flare up in orange blaze and circle into smoke like words. This is a poem for our time called The Worst. The Worst. Oh, it has an epigraph from King Lear. The worst is not so long as we can say, this is the worst. Something to keep in mind. No, not the worst. Not if it can be named. Say sorrow. Say disaster. Say no cure for the cared for or the caregiver. So long as grief is told in nimble sentences and images, so long as you can curse, not in whispers, but with heavy stresses, the curse will say, worsening, not the worst. Weak legs will stride, fall, strive, fall stronger, and stride again. For better or for worser, in blindness, verbs breed sight, in sickness, laughter. Words don't console, though they cut deeper in hard hours for the sea smell. For the weightlessness of a cormorant wing flapping on a buoy, for how on a leaking dory men haul bass and ride over shipwrecks on a choppy sea. I'm reading from my new collection, which is not published yet. It's not even finished. But that's what I like to read from unfinished work, just to see how it feels. And it's called The Sand Dancers. And this is the title poem. In a faded photo, they dance on shore, two kids we were, scuffing up bursts of sand, hands rise and fall in a rapid step slide, spin on bumpy sand hills, seawater creeping closer. They shimmy high as gulls on one another, and unaware, they're skipping on a grave. Death's relics gleam in sun, unrecognized. The black skull, once a horseshoe crab, the jellyfish with blood-red intestines, barnacles stuck fast on eyeless stones, nodding at them like beheaded saints. Chartreuse hair rising when waves recede. Commemorate the shipwreck off this coast. Voyagers and whalers catch fishermen. Now they join hands and swing out, rollicking, moonwalk on rocks sea-polished into eggs and fixed like pebbles visitors set on markers. Fresh as sea foam, bright as the break and shuffle of a long wave gone white before it roars, its turbulence their only orchestra. How could they know the years would sail them past this mud-drenched glow? Private losses, public wars, together, apart, together. Now it's heel toe, as if they didn't hear the clink of a buoy warning of danger as the chill wind lifts a wave's underbelly to gather force and strike in its time. This next poem is called Happiness. And the title is the same as the first line. Happiness is not a campfire, but an occulting light, a field of fireflies that blink on, off, on. The tree you planted, whose apples fall to the ground, half rotten, half sweet. The street's jackhammers that fall quiet at night. The black skimmer's white underside. The life together, apart together. The long marriage, oxymoronic in its dank joy. Under a half moon, quivering through sycamores, you held my body half the night as I lay in your arms, sometimes half awake, speculating, well, happy families are unalike. I choose you with your handicap, your half mobility, not to mention your leisure in forsaking all others, for the chance of our wholeness. I take you, my choice as certain, as plankton on sand lights up and arcs to the stars. This next poem is called Orchid. It was a lucky find. Not raised but found, this dancer, idling on trash, abandoned in the compactor room, fated to be smothered in a green bag. Seven blooms caught me, hot pink smiles in deadpan weather, on the year's shortest day before the longest night. Gingerly, sponging off ashes, eggshells, silvery powder, talc, I hope, from its mossy planter, I slide it toward high windows, and it changes like fire, sherry to red purple to magenta, colors of blood, a Beaujolais of sin and holiness, of saints on stained glass panels, light shining through a diva's fan. Fuchsia, the color named for a plant that must have jolted Leonhard Fuchs, the botanist, when he discovered it in the 16th century. My orchid's serious name is Phalaenopsis, for moths in flight. Its wingy blooms blink teasing just out of eye's reach. Sunsets, they turn the color of red ochre, mixed with manganese, powdered and blown, through reeds by the early cave painters, fearful of beasts, to glitter from a bison's frame. I don't know the exact shade of red-purple the Phoenicians used to dye robes for kings, but I think this was it. Also the color of a rose Yeats set afire to see its ghost. In my mind, the ancient Egyptian who painted amulets inside a royal tomb wished only for this sizzling fuchsia to wake the beloved dead as he mixed gypsum with rose matter in futile passion. Once as a child, I wandered in the park bordering my usual asphalt streets and saw a flower, red-purple on a stem with wings. I called to it, my angel. Now I give an orchid air and water, turn down the lumiere, stroke the crooked stem that darts out to reveal wings, whose vermilion burning against a window facing brick defies ending on this cold year's end. This next poem is called Image Worship. Faces on the lid of the Knabe Grand caught my eye when I tried the happy farmer, dreaming of plows far from my rutted sidewalks, digging not earth but notes, and neither happy nor a farmer. I hit wrong keys, taunted by the metronome. As a distraction, I stared at smiles in silver frames, war dead. I never knew them, heavy-fingered, longing for their lightness. I saw an uncle waving, somebody's hell-raiser climbing an oak, an aunt, a doctor's silk scarf blown in wind. Suddenly my face appeared among the faces soon to hide or to be interred, the woman's deep-set eyes in the black-white photograph, mine in the frame glass, merged, until the wind lifting her scarf blew through me. Now, when I stir to brighter images, a yellow coat, a fawn's sleek arabesque, I think of photographs and of Aeneas, who in a strange city, stunned by a shrine with pictures of his own city's destruction, broken statues, fires, the dead, cried out, Sunt lacrimae rerum, there are tears in things. My husband of 59 years died last year, and there are a number of poems in this book which are about marriage. And this one is called The Rooted Bed. Rooted Bed is an image from the Odyssey. Odysseus carved their bed out of an oak rooted to the ground. When the medics lifted your lean body that once loped over hot sand to the sea, I wanted them to keep you on our bed, resembling one that waited for Odysseus. He'd carved the bedpost from an olive tree, alive, still rooted to the earth. For hours, you'd found a board cut from an oak and sanded it until it shone like wheat, a platform for the mattress, unobtrusive under a quilt, yet there, your handiwork. In sickness, you lay on the rooted bed. It never moved, just as we stayed put in one apartment and heard things rise. Schubert's impromptus on a stereo you'd built, rooted with electric wires and plugs to be immovable as well. A pigeon that chirred on the high sill, you called it a rock dove, until it flew. Grand illusion on a video played over until we memorized the lines. The bed is still in place. At night, without you, I feel it quiver to put down new roots. This is a poem I wrote for my students at Baruch who were asking how can poetry be written in the terrible world we have, a world of terrible disasters and bloodshed. And this poem is called Because. Because in a universe of charred bodies, the grass still glistens. The first daffodil shoots up near snow melt, and a red-tailed hawk perches on a cathedral spire. Because children toss a ball in the yard where a schoolhouse facade was scarred by vandals, and joggers still circle a dry reservoir. Because a rainbow flaunts its ribbons and slips them underneath a blood-drenched earth. Because in a smoky bar the trombone blares louder than street sirens. Because those who can no longer speak of pain are singing. Because on this wide meadow in the park, a full moon still outshines the city lights. And when returning home, below the North Star, I see new bricks and glass where the towers fell. And I remember my love's calloused hand soften in my hand, while crab apple blossoms showered our laps. And a yellow rose opened with its satellites of orange buds. Because I cannot lose the injured world without losing the world, I'll have to praise it. The Lost Explorers. Give me the Lost Explorers, the last scenes, gone missings, vanished in fog, no wreckage found, with names that ring with danger, like Umora and Crozier, or rhyme with awe like Fawcett. Lost seeing Z, the last alphabet letter, the hidden city in Brazil he'd peer at through jungle vines. Perhaps he found it, walked with a lover there, and never left. I'll take the one who feels exile at home and breathes deep on departures, who would quit leather recliners for a matchbox plane to soar in, clutching a windblown chart, or one who drives a dog sled through the snow's blank pages, the way unmarked by tracks or wheel ruts, and the life an open question. Names echo like the last notes of a fugue. Watch them stir to chatter in hissing consonants and growl of a new language. Dare them to travel across the world's time zones until they find extra days, past and future. I'll cheer for listeners to windsong, losing balance only to right themselves. Who hasn't walked on steadier once lost? Just as I write this with broken compass and no GPS.